This is the High Roads Media presentation of The Law of Success, Volume 1, The Principles of Self-Mastery, written by Napoleon Hill and read by Arthur Mori, with contemporary commentaries read by Tony Hudds. And now, beginning with the preface to the revised edition, Arthur Mori reads.
Preface to the revised edition. Updating one of Napoleon Hill's most enduringly popular and helpful works is an intimidating task. The Law of Success was first published in 1928 as a set of 8 volumes. Its reception was phenomenal. It won immediate endorsement from 2 former presidents of the United States, as well as a legion of other prominent figures from all walks of life, including inventor Thomas Edison, business tycoon F.W. Woolworth, and labor leader Samuel Gompers. Since then, in various forms, The Law of Success has been reprinted more than 50 times. The power and usefulness of its message endure. Napoleon Hill's name has been synonymous with success motivation for generations of Americans. His influence is reflected in the works of countless successors. Like Hill's other books, such as Think and Grow Rich and Keys to Success, this book has guided millions of people to discover and pursue what they want most from life. Readers familiar with those books will recognize some differences in Hill's ideas in this work, particularly in the number of key principles and in their wording, but the power and wisdom of Hill's ideas are clearly, unmistakably here. Why then change anything about the book? Why tinker with success? Because, quite simply, Napoleon Hill's whole life was a process of discovery. He dedicated himself to uncovering the qualities and traits that made great individuals, and for more than 40 years after the publication of The Law of Success, he continued to observe and interpret lives of successful people. There was nothing static about his approach. He refined and clarified his ideas at every opportunity so that they would be more useful to his readers. This new edition of The Law of Success attempts to continue that effort. New examples of the application of Hill's ideas have been added to show that those ideas remain just as important, just as useful as they ever were. Publisher's note. Before everything else, Napoleon Hill was an inspiring public speaker. The Law of Success, as Hill likes to remind us, began as a lecture series. It was tested before many hundreds of audiences and molded by their responses. In print, it was issued piecemeal at first in different editions with slightly differing formats. Like many great men who belong to an oral tradition, Hill was constantly, throughout his life, updating and modifying his ideas. In reissuing The Law of Success, we hope to reconcile Hill, the developer of seminal ideas, with Hill, the presenter and interpreter. On one hand, this edition presents Hill's ideas in their most complete, most comprehensive and original form. It is true to the text using all materials, including pamphlets and addenda, ever published under the Law of Success title. At the same time, it is true to the man. We attempt to allow Hill to be as modern an author as if he were still among us. We have accomplished the second goal in 3 ways. First, where there was repetition of ideas, we selected the most comprehensive example, adding commentary to illustrate variations. Second, we included other commentaries that illustrate Hill's points with more modern examples. For purposes of clarity, all such commentaries, as well as various quotations drawn from other writings of Mr. Hill and inserted in this program, will be read by a second voice, that of Tony Hudds. Finally, and this is the most delicate issue, we have treated the text itself as we would the text of a living author. When we feel that something is obscure or misleading because the author's language is idiosyncratic or archaic, or because it might be construed as racist or sexist, we have made minor changes. Also, where Hill digresses, as when talking about physics or psychology, to discuss theories that have since been revised, we have made minor revisions. For anyone who has ever been moved or affected by Hill's ideas, and know it or not, most of us have, this edition will set the standard for decades to come. We hope and believe that when Mr. Hill sits in our mastermind group and gives us his take on the work we have done, he will express his hearty approval. We rather expect he will also cheerfully suggest further improvements. When The Law of Success was first published in 1928, Hill wrote of an age of greater opportunity, in which he believed that Americans had unprecedented freedom to make of themselves what they would. The new material in this text shows that despite an ensuing depression and several wars, despite tumultuous political and cultural change, that age endures into the present and shows no sign of vanishing. Much of the modern world would have astounded and delighted Napoleon Hill, who was born in Backwoods, Virginia during the presidency of Chester A. Arthur. Fax machines, the internet, magnetic resonance imaging, gene therapy, these were all still dreams in the minds of individuals when Hill passed away in 1970. But they represent exactly the kind of exciting innovation and progress he so passionately believed would come from dedicated human effort. The trustees of the Napoleon Hill Foundation have ordered this new edition of The Law of Success with full confidence that it continues a long and proud tradition of pointing the way to personal achievement. It can do no more than that. Success in such a pursuit depends on your choices and your actions. This volume is the first of four that will contain the entire revised text of The Law of Success. In it, you will learn of Hill's belief in the power of the human mind and of his deeply held conviction that each of us must discover a clear purpose for our lives. These are the foundations of the pursuit of success. You will also learn of the importance of self-confidence in that pursuit and the necessity of conserving and marshaling your resources no matter how you define success for yourself. Later volumes will teach you other important lessons, such as leadership and imagination, accurate thinking and concentration, cooperation and learning from your mistakes. Together, these four volumes will be the most complete and authoritative guide you will ever encounter to making the most of yourself and your efforts. Success is not achieved by application of a simple three-step program. It depends on a fully concentrated, comprehensive plan of action that enlists all of your abilities. Devote yourself to understanding each of the four lessons in this program before you move on to the next. When you have completed Lesson 2, review Lesson 1 before beginning Lesson 3 so that you refresh your understanding of the Law of Success. You will find as you progress that each subsequent lesson depends on understanding all those that have preceded it. It does you little good and potentially much damage to know how to use the accelerator of a car if you have forgotten how to steer or brake. So, resolve to make the most of the tremendous opportunity this course represents. Prepare yourself to alter the way in which you think about success and how it is attained. Hundreds of thousands of other men and women have improved their careers, fortunes, family life, and sense of themselves on the basis of the Law of Success. You can too.
Who said it could not be done? And what great victories has he to his credit, which qualify him to judge others accurately?
And now we begin Volume 1 of The Law of Success, The Principles of Self-Mastery. Perhaps Henry Ford and Andrew Carnegie should be acknowledged as having contributed most toward the building of this course, for the reason that it was Andrew Carnegie who first suggested the writing of the course, and Henry Ford whose life work supplied much of the material out of which the course was developed. Some of the men who helped to shape my thoughts are now deceased, but to those who are still living, I wish to make here a grateful acknowledgement of the service they have rendered, without which this book never could have been written. I have studied the majority of these people at close range, in person. With many of them I enjoy, or did enjoy before their death, the privilege of close, personal friendship which enabled me to gather from their philosophy facts that would not have been available under other conditions. I am grateful for having enjoyed the privilege of enlisting the services of the most powerful human beings on earth in the building of the Law of Success course. That privilege has been remuneration enough for the work done, if nothing more were ever received for it. They have been the backbone and the foundation and the skeleton of American business, finance, industry, and statesmanship. The Law of Success course epitomizes the philosophy and the rules of procedure which made each of these men a great power in his chosen field of endeavor. It has been my intention to present the course in the plainest and most simple terms available, so it could be mastered by very young men and women of high school age. With the exception of the psychological law referred to in Lesson 1 as the mastermind, I don't claim to having created anything basically new in this course. What I have done, however, has been to organize old truths and known laws into practical, usable form, where they may be properly interpreted and applied by the workaday person whose needs call for a philosophy of simplicity. In passing upon the merits of the Law of Success, Judge Elbert H. Gerry said, "Two outstanding features connected with the philosophy impress me most. One is the simplicity with which it has been presented, and the other is the fact that its soundness is so obvious to all that it will be immediately accepted." Unquote. The student of this course is warned against passing judgment upon it before having heard the entire 17 lessons. This especially applies to this introduction, in which it has been necessary to include brief references to subjects of a more or less technical and scientific nature. The reason for this will be obvious after the student has listened to the entire 17 lessons. The listener who takes up this course with an open mind and sees to it that his or her mind remains open until the last lesson is finished will be richly rewarded with a broader and more accurate view of life as a whole. A personal statement by Napoleon Hill from the 1928 edition. Some 30 years ago, a young clergyman by the name of Gonsalves announced in the newspapers of Chicago that he would preach a sermon the following Sunday morning entitled, "What I Would Do If I Had $1,000,000." The announcement caught the eye of Philip D. Armour, the wealthy packing house king who decided to hear the sermon. In his sermon, Dr. Gonsalves pictured a great school of technology where young men and young women could be taught how to succeed in life by developing the ability to think in practical rather than in theoretical terms, where they would be taught to learn by doing. "If I had $1,000,000," said the young preacher, "I would start such a school." After the sermon was over, Mr. Armour walked down the aisle to the pulpit, introduced himself, and said, "Young man, I believe you could do all you said you could, and if you will come down to my office tomorrow morning, I will give you $1,000,000 you need." Unquote. There is always plenty of capital for those who can create practical plans for using it. That was the beginning of the Armour Institute of Technology, one of the very practical schools of the country. The school was born in the imagination of a young man who never would have been heard of outside of the community in which he preached, had it not been for the imagination plus the capital of Philip D. Armour. Every great railroad, and every outstanding financial institution, and every mammoth business enterprise, and every great invention began in the imagination of some one person. F.W. Woolworth created the 5- and 10-cent stores plan in his imagination before it became a reality and made him a multimillionaire. Thomas A. Edison created the talking machine and the moving picture machine and the incandescent electric light bulb and scores of other useful inventions in his own imagination before they became a reality. After the Chicago fire, scores of merchants whose stores went up in smoke stood near the smoldering embers of their former places of business, grieving over their loss. Many of them decided to go away into other cities and start over again. In the group was Marshall Field, who saw, in his own imagination, the world's greatest retail store standing on the same spot where his former store had stood, which was then but a ruined mass of smoking timbers. That store became a reality. Fortunate is the young man or young woman who learns early in life to use imagination, and doubly so in this age of greater opportunity. Imagination is a faculty of the mind which can be cultivated, developed, extended, and broadened by use. If this were not true, this course on the 17 Laws of Success never would have been created, because it was first conceived in my imagination from the mere seed of an idea which was sown by a chance remark of the late Andrew Carnegie. "Wherever you are, whoever you are, whatever you may be following as an occupation, there is room for you to make yourself more useful, and in that manner more productive by developing and using your imagination." Success in this world is always a matter of individual effort, yet you will only be deceiving yourself if you believe that you can succeed without the cooperation of other people. Success is a matter of individual effort only to the extent that each person must decide in his or her own mind what is wanted. This involves the use of imagination. From this point on, Achieving success is a matter of skillfully and tactfully inducing others to cooperate. Before you can secure cooperation from others, before you have the right to ask for or expect cooperation from other people, you must first show a willingness to cooperate with them. For this reason, the eighth lesson of this course, the habit of doing more than paid for, is one which should have your serious and thoughtful attention. The law upon which this lesson is based would of itself practically ensure success to all who practice it in all they do. The purpose of the Law of Success course is to enable you to find out how you may become more capable in your chosen field of work. To this end, you will be analyzed and all of your qualities classified so you may organize them and make the best possible use of them. You may not like the work in which you are now engaged. There are two ways of getting out of that work. One way is to take but little interest in what you are doing, aiming merely to do enough with which to get by. Very soon you will find a way out because the demand for your services will cease. The other and better way is by making yourself so useful and efficient in what you are now doing that you will attract the favorable attention of those who have the power to promote you into more responsible work that is more to your liking. It is your privilege to take your choice as to which way you will proceed. Thousands of people walked over the Great Calumet Copper Mine without discovering it. Just one lone man used his imagination, dug down into the earth a few feet, investigated, and discovered the richest copper deposit on earth. You and every other person walk, at one time or another, over your own Calumet mine. Discovery is a matter of investigation and use of imagination. This course on the 17 Laws of Success may lead the way to your Calumet, and you may be surprised when you discover that you were standing right over this rich mine in the work in which you are now engaged. In his lecture on Acres of Diamonds, Russell Conwell tells us that we need not seek opportunity in the distance, that we may find it right where we stand. This is a truth well worth remembering.
Time is a master worker that heals the wounds of temporary defeat and equalizes the inequalities and rights the wrongs of the world. There is nothing impossible with time.
Lesson 1. An Introduction to the Mastermind. You can do it if you believe you can. This is a course on the fundamentals of success. Success is very largely a matter of adjusting oneself to the ever-varying and changing environments of life in a spirit of harmony and poise. Harmony is based upon an understanding of the forces constituting one's environment. Therefore, this course is, in reality, a blueprint that may be followed straight to success because it helps you interpret, understand, and make the most of these environmental forces of life. Before you begin listening to the Law of Success lessons, you should know something of the history of this course. You should know exactly what the course promises to those who follow it until they have assimilated the laws and principles upon which it is based. You should know its limitations as well as its possibilities as an aid in your fight for a place in the world. From the viewpoint of entertainment, the Law of Success course would be a poor second to most of any of the monthly periodicals of the snappy story variety which may be found upon the newsstands.
It has been said that Napoleon Hill and his philosophy of success have made more millionaires than any other person in history. It might equally well be said that Napoleon Hill inspired more motivational experts than any other man in history. Napoleon Hill was, and 30 years after his death, continues to be, America's most influential motivational author and lecturer. That is partly due to the fact that he came to prominence at the beginning of the age of mass communications, but it is due in even larger part to the diligence he applied to the research upon which he based his 17 principles that comprise the Law of Success. It is practically impossible to find a motivational speaker who does not draw upon Hill's work. His influence can be seen in the writings of his early peers, Dale Carnegie and Norman Vincent Peale. Later, many successful authors and speakers such as W. Clement Stone, Og Mandino, Earl Nightingale, and Chicken Soup author Mark Victor Hansen either worked directly with Napoleon Hill or with the Napoleon Hill Foundation. Echoes of Hill's principles can be seen in books by people as diverse as Jose Silva, Mary Kay Ash, Dr. Maxwell Maltz, Shakti Gawain, Wally Famous Amos, and Dr. Bernie Siegel. Anthony Robbins, arguably the most successful motivational speaker of the last decade, has often cited Napoleon Hill as his inspiration. And best-selling author Stephen Covey's The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People can be found in the 17 principles Hill wrote about 70 years earlier.
A Course in Success. The course has been created for the serious-minded person who devotes at least a portion of his or her time to the business of succeeding in life. I have not intended to compete with those who write purely for purposes of entertaining. My aim in preparing this course has been of a twofold nature. First, to help you discover your weaknesses, and second, to help create a definite plan for bridging those weaknesses. The most successful men and women on earth have had to correct certain weak spots in their personalities before they began to succeed. The most outstanding of these weaknesses that stand between men and women and success are intolerance, greed, jealousy, suspicion, revenge, egotism, conceit, the tendency to reap where they have not sown, and the habit of spending more than they earn. All of these common enemies of mankind and many more not here mentioned are covered by the Law of Success course in such a manner that any person of reasonable intelligence may master them with but little effort or inconvenience. You should know at the very outset that the Law of Success course has long since passed through the experimental state, that it already has to its credit a record of achievement that is worthy of serious thought and analysis. You should also know that the Law of Success course has been examined and endorsed by some of the most practical minds of modern times. The Law of Success Lectures. The Law of Success course was first used as a lecture, and I delivered it in practically every city and in many of the smaller localities throughout the United States over a period of more than 7 years. During these lectures, I had assistants located in the audiences to interpret the reaction of those who heard the lecture, and in this manner we learned exactly what effect it had upon people. As a result of this study and analysis, many changes were made. The first big victory of the Law of Success philosophy was gained when it was used as the basis of a course that trained 3,000 men and women as a sales army. Few of these people had previous experience of any sort in the field of selling. Through this training, they were enabled to earn more than $1 million for themselves and paid me $30,000 for my services over a period of approximately 6 months. The individuals and small groups of salespeople who have found success through the aid of this course are too numerous to be mentioned in this introduction, but the number is large and the benefits they derived from the course were definite. The Law of Success philosophy was brought to the attention of the late Don R. Mellett, former publisher of the Canton, Ohio Daily News, who formed a partnership with me and was preparing to resign as publisher of the Canton Daily News and take up the business management of my affairs when he was assassinated on July 16, 1926. Prior to his death, Mr. Mellett had made arrangements with Judge Elbert H. Gary, who was then chairman of the board of the United States Steel Corporation, to present the Law of Success course to every employee of the Steel Corporation at a total cost of something like $150,000. This plan was halted because of Judge Gary's death, but it proves that the Law of Success is an educational plan of an enduring nature. Judge Gary was eminently prepared to judge the value of such a course, and the fact that he analyzed the Law of Success philosophy and was preparing to invest the huge sum of $150,000 in it is proof of the soundness of all that is said in behalf of the course. Terminology. You will observe in this general introduction a few technical terms that may not be plain to you. Don't let this bother you. Make no attempt at first hearing to understand these terms. They will be plain to you after you listen to the remainder of the course. This entire introduction is intended only as a background for the 17 lessons of the course, and you should listen to it as such. You should listen to this introduction many times, as you will get from it at each hearing a thought or an idea which you did not get on previous hearings. In this introduction, you will find a description of a newly discovered law of psychology that is the very foundation stone of all outstanding personal achievements. I refer to this as the mastermind, meaning a mind that is developed through the harmonious cooperation of two or more people who ally themselves for the purpose of accomplishing any given task.
As you listen to this program, you will occasionally encounter a term such as mastermind that has, in the years since Napoleon Hill coined the term, taken on a connotation that he never intended. Hill first published this work in 1927, a time when Freud and Jung were still developing the study of human psychology, and the terminology had not yet found its way into common usage. The now commonly accepted psychological term that comes closest to capturing what Napoleon Hill meant by the mastermind is what Jung called the collective unconscious. But what Hill was describing goes beyond Jung's theory to include other concepts, including Edward de Bono's techniques of lateral thinking and brainstorming, and many of the ideas behind modern management buzzwords such as quality circles, synergy, and thinking outside the box. Hill's term, mastermind, may seem quaint to the modern listener, but for all the psychobabble that is now part of everyday speech, there is no other term that encompasses all that Hill had in mind.
If you are engaged in the business of selling, you may profitably experiment with this law of the mastermind in your daily work. It has been found that a group of 6 or 7 salespeople may use the law so effectively that their sales may be increased to unbelievable proportions. Life insurance is supposed to be the hardest thing on earth to sell. This ought not to be true with an established necessity such as life insurance, but it is. Nevertheless, a small group of people working for the Prudential Life Insurance Company, whose sales are mostly small policies, formed a little friendly group for the purposes of experimenting with the law of the mastermind, with the result that every man in the group wrote more insurance during the first 3 months of the experiment than he had ever written in an entire year before. What may be accomplished through the aid of this principle by any small group of intelligent salesmen who have learned how to apply the law of the mastermind will stagger the imagination of the most highly optimistic and imaginative person. Bear this in mind as you hear this Introduction to the Law of Success course, and it is not unreasonable to expect that this introduction alone may give you sufficient understanding of the law to change the entire course of your life.
No man has a chance to enjoy permanent success until he begins to look in a mirror for the real cause of all his mistakes.
Personalities. It is the personalities back of a business that determine the measure of success the business will enjoy. Modify those personalities so they are more pleasing and more attractive to the patrons of the business, and the business will thrive. In any of the great cities of the United States, merchandise of similar nature and price can be found in scores of stores. Yet you will find there is always one outstanding store which does more business than any of the others. The reason for this is that back of that store is someone who has attended to the personalities of those who come in contact with the public. People buy personalities as much as merchandise, and it is a question if they are not influenced more by the personalities with which they come in contact than they are by the merchandise.
Hill is prophetic in these words. His description of the importance of personality and service in business anticipates the growth of the service industries that have, by the end of the century, dominated the economy.
Service. Life insurance has been reduced to such a scientific basis that the cost of insurance does not vary to any great extent, regardless of the company from which one purchases it. Yet out of the hundreds of life insurance companies doing business, less than a dozen companies do the bulk of the business of the United States. Why? Personalities. 99 people out of every 100 who purchase life insurance policies do not know what is in their policies, and what seems more startling, do not seem to care. What they really purchase is the pleasing personality of some man or woman who knows the value of cultivating such a personality. Your business in life, or at least the most important part of it, is to achieve success. Success, within the meaning of that term as covered by this course on the 17 Laws of Success, is the attainment of your definite chief aim without violating the rights of other people. Regardless of what your major aim in life may be, you will attain it with much less difficulty after you learn how to cultivate a pleasing personality, and after you have learned the delicate art of aligning yourself with others in a given undertaking without friction or envy.
If you must slander someone, don't speak it, but write it. Write it in the sand, near the water's edge.
One of the greatest problems of life, if not in fact the greatest, is that of learning the art of harmonious negotiation with others. This course was created for the purpose of teaching people how to negotiate their way through life with harmony and poise, free from the destructive effects of disagreement and friction which bring millions of people to misery, want, and failure every year. With this statement of the purpose of the course, you should be able to approach the lessons with the feeling that a complete transformation is about to take place in your personality. You cannot enjoy outstanding success in life without power, and you can never enjoy power without sufficient personality to influence other people to cooperate with you in a spirit of harmony. This course shows you, step by step, how to develop such a personality. Lesson by lesson, the following is a statement of that which you may expect to receive from the 17 Laws of Success. 1. The mastermind will outline the physical and psychological laws that underlie these lessons. 2. A definite chief aim will teach you how to save the wasted effort that the majority of people expend in trying to find their life work. This lesson will show you how to do away forever with aimlessness and fix your heart and hand upon some definite, well-conceived purpose as a life work. 3. Self-confidence will help you master the 6 basic fears with which every person is cursed: the fear of poverty, the fear of ill health, the fear of old age, the fear of criticism, the fear of loss of love of someone, and the fear of death. It will teach you the difference between egotism and real self-confidence that is based upon definite, usable knowledge. 4. The habit of saving will teach you how to distribute your income systematically so that a definite percentage of it will steadily accumulate, thus forming one of the greatest known sources of personal power. No one may succeed in life without saving money. There is no exception to this rule, and no one may escape it. 5. Initiative and leadership will show you how to become a leader instead of a follower in your chosen field of endeavor. It will develop in you the instinct for leadership that will cause you to gradually gravitate to the top in all undertakings in which you participate. 6. Imagination will stimulate your mind so that you will conceive new ideas and develop new plans that will help you in attaining the object of your definite chief aim. This lesson will teach you how to build new houses out of old stones, so to speak. It will show you how to create new ideas out of old, well-known concepts, and how to put old ideas to new uses. 7. Enthusiasm will enable you to saturate all with whom you come in contact, with interest in you and in your ideas. Enthusiasm is the foundation of a pleasing personality, and you must have such a personality in order to influence others to cooperate with you. 8. Self-control is the balance wheel with which you control your enthusiasm and direct it where you wish it to carry you. This lesson will teach you in a most practical manner to become the master of your fate, the captain of your soul. 9. The habit of doing more than paid for is one of the most important lessons of the Law of Success course. It will teach you how to take advantage of the law of increasing returns, which will eventually ensure you a return in money far out of proportion to the service you render. No one may become a real leader in any walk of life without practicing the habit of doing more work and better work than that for which he or she is paid. 10. A pleasing personality is the fulcrum on which you must place the crowbar of your efforts, and when so placed with intelligence, it will enable you to remove mountains of obstacles. This one lesson alone has made scores of master salesmen. It has developed leaders overnight. It will teach you how to transform your personality so that you may adapt yourself to any environment or to any other personality in such a manner that you may easily dominate. 11. Accurate thinking is one of the important foundation stones of all enduring success. This lesson teaches you how to separate facts from mere information. It teaches you how to organize known facts into 2 classes, the important and the unimportant. It teaches you how to determine what is an important fact. It teaches you how to build definite working plans in the pursuit of any calling based on facts. 12. Concentration teaches you how to focus your attention upon one subject at a time until you have worked out practical plans for mastering that subject. It will teach you how to ally yourself with others in such a manner that you may have the use of their entire knowledge to back you up in your own plans and purposes. It will give you a practical working knowledge of the forces around you and show you how to harness and use these forces in furthering your own interests. 13. Cooperation will teach you the value of teamwork in all you do. In this lesson, you will be taught how to apply the law of the mastermind described in this introduction and in Lesson 2 of this course. This lesson will show you how to coordinate your own efforts with those of others in such a manner that friction, jealousy, strife, envy, and greed will be eliminated. You will learn how to make use of all that other people have learned about the work in which you are engaged. 14. Profiting by failure will teach you how to make stepping stones out of all your past and future mistakes and failures. It will teach you the difference between failure and temporary defeat, a difference which is very great and very important. It will teach you how to profit by your own failures and by the failures of other people. 15. Tolerance will teach you how to avoid the disastrous effects of racial and religious prejudices which mean defeat for millions of people who permit themselves to become entangled in foolish argument over these subjects, thereby poisoning their own minds and closing the door to reason and investigation. This lesson is the twin sister of the one on accurate thought, for the reason that no one may become an accurate thinker without practicing tolerance. Intolerance closes the book of knowledge and writes on the cover, "Fini. I have learned it all." Intolerance makes enemies of those who should be friends. It destroys opportunities and fills the mind with doubt, mistrust, and prejudice. 16. Practicing the Golden Rule will teach you how to make use of this great universal law of human conduct in such a manner that you may easily get harmonious cooperation from any individual or group of individuals. Lack of understanding of the law upon which the Golden Rule philosophy is based is one of the major causes of failure of millions of people who remain in misery, poverty, and want all their lives. This lesson has nothing whatsoever to do with religion in any form, nor with sectarianism, nor have any of the other lessons of this course on the law of success. 17. The Universal Law will show you how to apply the principles you have learned in studying the first 16 lessons to transform not only your thoughts, but also your habits. And through this change in the ways you behave and respond, you will put yourself in total harmony with your environment. Success is a result of achieving such harmony. When you have mastered these 17 laws and made them your own, as you may do within a period of from 15 to 30 weeks, you will be ready to develop sufficient personal power to ensure the attainment of your definite chief aim. The purpose of these 17 laws is to develop or help you organize all the knowledge you have and all you acquire in the future so you may turn this knowledge into power. You should listen to the law of success with a notebook by your side, for you will observe that ideas will begin to flash into your mind as you listen, as to ways and means of using these laws in advancing your own interests. You should also begin teaching these laws to those in whom you are most interested, as it is a well-known fact that the more one tries to teach a subject, the more one learns about that subject. A parent with a family of young boys and girls may so indelibly fix these 17 laws of success in their minds that this teaching will change the entire course of their lives. The parent with a family should interest his or her spouse in studying this course also, for reasons that will be plain before you complete listening to this introduction. Power is one of the three basic objects of human endeavor. Power is of two classes, that developed through coordination of natural physical laws, and that developed by organizing and classifying knowledge. Power growing out of organized knowledge is the more important because it places in your possession a tool with which you may transform, redirect, and to some extent harness and use the other form of power. The object of this listening course is to mark the route by which you may safely travel in gathering such facts as you wish to weave into your fabric of knowledge. There are two major methods of gathering knowledge, namely, by studying, classifying, and assimilating facts which have been organized by other people, and through one's own process of gathering, organizing, and classifying facts, generally called personal experience. This lesson deals mainly with the ways and means of studying the facts and data gathered and classified by other people.
In the following section, Hill explains basic laws of physics as they were understood in his time. There are errors in his understanding that will be recognized by even non-scientists. Hill, for example, says that electrons may be either positive or negative. An electron, we now know, always carries a negative charge. And a whole branch of physics studies particles much smaller than the electron, a world Hill doesn't have an inkling of. Where Hill digresses to discuss specifics, small sections have been deleted. Hill would have deleted them himself had he known more. But it is important to listen to the outlines of his description of physical matter as a metaphor or parallel for the laws that govern human behavior. That is the way he intended this section to be heard. Hill is here trying to find a physical basis to explain the extremely mysterious, but altogether indisputable power of the mastermind.
The mastermind and the structure of the universe. In the past few centuries, scientists have discovered and cataloged the physical elements of which all material forms in the universe consist. By study and analysis and accurate measurement, humans have discovered the bigness of the material side of the universe, as represented by planets, suns, and stars, some of which are known to be over 10 million times as large as the little Earth on which he lives. On the other hand, man has discovered the littleness of the physical forms that constitute the universe by reducing the physical elements to molecules, atoms, and finally to the smallest particle, the electron. An electron cannot be seen. It is but a center of force consisting of a positive or a negative. The electron is the beginning of everything of a physical nature. Molecules, atoms, and electrons. To understand both the detail and the perspective of the process through which knowledge is gathered, organized, and classified, it seems essential to begin with the smallest and simplest particles of physical matter, because these are the ABCs with which nature has constructed the entire framework of the physical portion of the universe. The molecule consists of atoms, which are little invisible particles of matter revolving continuously with the speed of lightning on exactly the same principle that the Earth revolves around the Sun. These little particles of matter, known as atoms, which revolve in one continuous circuit in the molecule, are made up of electrons, the smallest particles of physical matter. As already stated, the electron is nothing but two forms of force. The electron is uniform, of but one class, size, and nature. Thus, in a grain of sand or a drop of water, the entire principle upon which the whole universe operates is duplicated. How marvelous! How stupendous! You may gather some slight idea of the magnitude of it all the next time you eat a meal by remembering that every article of food you eat, the plate on which you eat it, the tableware, and the table itself are, in final analysis, but a collection of electrons. In the world of physical matter, whether one is looking at the largest star that floats through the heavens or the smallest grain of sand to be found on Earth, the object under observation is but an organized collection of molecules, atoms, and electrons revolving around one another at inconceivable speed. Nothing is ever still, although nearly all physical matter may appear to the physical eye to be motionless. There is no solid physical matter. The hardest piece of steel is but an organized mass of revolving particles. Moreover, the electrons in a piece of steel are of the same nature and move at the same rate of speed as the electrons in gold, silver, brass, or pewter. The forms of physical matter appear to be different from one another, and they are different because they are made up of different combinations of atoms. Although the electrons in these atoms are always the same, except that some electrons are positive and some are negative, meaning that some carry a positive charge of electrification while others carry a negative charge.
Don't be afraid of a little opposition. Remember that the kite of success generally rises against the wind of adversity, not with it.
Through the science of chemistry, matter may be broken up into atoms which are within themselves unchangeable. The elements are created through and by reason of combining and changing of the positions of the atoms. Thus it may be seen that the physical elements of the universe differ from one another only in the number of electrons composing their atoms and the number and arrangement of those atoms in the molecules of each element. As an illustration, an atom of mercury contains 80 positive charges, electrons in its nucleus, and 80 negative outlying charges, also electrons. If only the chemist were to expel two of those positive electrons, it would instantly become the metal known as platinum. If only the chemist could then go a step further and transform the platinum into gold. The formula through which this electronic change might be produced has been the object of diligent search by the alchemists all down through the ages, and by the modern chemists of today. It is a fact known to every chemist that literally tens of thousands of synthetic substances may be composed out of only four kinds of atoms, that is, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon. It may be stated as a literal truth that the atom is the universal particle with which nature builds all material forms, from a grain of sand to the largest star that floats through space. The atom is nature's building block, out of which she erects an oak tree or a pine, a rock of sandstone or granite, a mouse, or an elephant. These facts concerning the smallest analyzable particles of matter have been briefly referred to as a starting point from which we shall undertake to ascertain how to develop and apply the law of power.
Hill is indicating here that the universe is filled with invisible, untapped energy. It is the kind of energy that would later be demonstrated in the explosion of the first atomic bomb. But the essential message of this example is this. Around a clump of matter, there is a swirl of energy. That energy determines whether something attracts other objects or whether it repels them. The nature of this energy can allow two hydrogen atoms to bond with an oxygen atom to form a molecule of water, or a sodium and a chloride atom to join to create a molecule of salt. The nuclei of the atoms are never changed, but the atoms themselves are joined into something new because of the nature of their energy. In a mastermind group, the energy of their individual minds surrounds the people who comprise the group. Their energies interact, and what results is something new and different.
Vibrating matter. It has been noticed that all matter is in a constant state of vibration or motion, that the molecule is made up of rapidly moving particles called atoms, which in turn are made up of rapidly moving particles called electrons. In every particle of matter, there is an invisible force which causes the atoms to circle around one another at an inconceivable rate of speed. One rate of vibration causes what is known as sound. The human ear can detect only the sound that is produced from 20 to about 20,000 cycles per second. As the rate of cycles per second increases above that which we call sound, they begin to manifest themselves in the form of heat. Still higher up the scale, vibrations or cycles begin to register in the form of light. Ultraviolet rays are normally invisible, and energy with a wavelength of higher order than ultraviolet is also invisible but can have a tremendous effect on physical objects. Science is still probing these upper limits, and perhaps future discoveries will explain what today remains a mystery. Yet still higher up the scale, just how high no one is able to say at this point, the vibrations or cycles create the power, I believe, with which human beings think.
Render more service than that for which you are paid, and you will soon be paid for more than you render. The law of increasing returns takes care of this.
It is my belief that all vibration, out of which grow all known forms of energy, is universal in nature, that the fluid portion of light, the difference in effect between sound and light being only a difference in rate of vibration, also that of thought is exactly the same as that in sound, heat, and light, excepting the number of vibrations per second. Just as there is but one form of physical matter, of which the earth and all the other planets, suns, and stars are composed, so there is but one form of energy, which causes all matter to remain in a constant state of rapid motion. Dr. Alexander Graham Bell, inventor of the long-distance telephone and one of the accepted authorities on the subject of vibration, is here introduced in support of my theories of vibration. Quote, suppose you have the power to make an iron rod vibrate with any desired frequency in a dark room. At first, when vibrating slowly, its movement will be indicated only by one sense, that of touch. As soon as the vibrations increase, a low sound will emanate from it and it will appeal to two senses. At about 32,000 vibrations to the second, the sound will be loud and shrill, but at 40,000 vibrations, it will be silent and the movements of the rod will not be perceived by touch. Its movements will be perceived by no ordinary human sense. From this point up to about 1.5 million vibrations per second, we have no sense that can appreciate any effect of the intervening vibrations. After that stage is reached, movement is indicated first by the sense of temperature, and then, when the rod becomes red hot, by the sense of sight. At 3 million vibrations, it sheds violet light. Above that, it sheds ultraviolet rays and other invisible radiations, some of which can be perceived by instruments and employed by us. Now, it has occurred to me that there must be a great deal to be learned about the effect of those vibrations in the great gap where the ordinary human senses are unable to hear, see, or feel the movement. The power to send wireless messages by ether vibrations lies in that gap. But the gap is so great that it seems there must be much more. You must make machines practically to supply new senses as the wireless instruments do. Can it be said, when you think of that great gap, that there are not many forms of vibrations that may give us results as wonderful as, or even more wonderful than, the wireless waves? It seems to me that in this gap lie the vibrations that we have assumed to be given off by our brains and nerve cells when we think. But then again, they may be higher up in the scale beyond the vibrations that produce the ultraviolet rays. Do we need a wire to carry these vibrations? Will they not pass through the ether without a wire, just as the wireless waves do? How will they be perceived by the recipient? Will he hear a series of signals, or will he find that another man's thoughts have entered into his brain? We may indulge in some speculations based on what we know of the wireless waves, which, as I have said, are all we can recognize of a vast series of vibrations which theoretically must exist. If the thought waves are similar to the wireless waves, they must pass from the brain and flow endlessly around the world and the universe. The body and the skull and other solid obstacles would form no obstruction to their passage as they pass through the ether which surrounds the molecules of every substance, no matter how solid and dense. You ask if there would not be constant interference and confusion if other people's thoughts were flowing through our brains and setting up thoughts in them that did not originate with ourselves? How do you know that other men's thoughts are not interfering with yours now? I have noticed many phenomena of mind disturbances that I have never been able to explain. For instance, there is the inspiration or the discouragement that a speaker feels in addressing an audience. I have experienced this many times in my life and have never been able to define exactly the physical causes of it. Many recent scientific discoveries, in my opinion, point to a day not far distant, perhaps, when men will read one another's thoughts, when thoughts will be conveyed directly from brain to brain without intervention of speech, writing, or any of the present known methods of communication. It is not unreasonable to look forward to a time when we shall see without eyes, hear without ears, and talk without tongues. Briefly, the hypothesis that mind can communicate directly with mind rests on the theory that thought or vital force is a form of electrical disturbance, that it can be taken up by induction and transmitted to a distance either through a wire or simply through the all-pervading ether, as in the case of wireless telegraph waves. There are many analogies suggesting that thought is of the nature of an electrical disturbance. A nerve, which is of the same substance as the brain, is an excellent conductor of the electrical current. When we first passed an electrical current through the nerves of a dead man, we were shocked and amazed to see him sit up and move. The electrified nerves produced contraction of the muscles very much as in life. The nerves appear to act upon the muscles very much as the electric current acts upon an electromagnet. The current magnetizes a bar of iron placed at right angles to it, and the nerves produce, through the intangible current of vital force that flows through them, contraction of the muscular fibers that are arranged at right angles to them. It would be possible to cite many reasons why thought and vital force may be regarded as of the same nature as electricity. The electric current is held to be a wave motion of the ether, the hypothetical substance that fills all space and pervades all substances. We believe that there must be ether because without it the electrical current could not pass through a vacuum or sunlight through space. It is reasonable to believe that only a wave motion of a similar character can produce the phenomena of thought and vital force. We may assume that the brain cells act as a battery and that the current produced flows along the nerves. But does it end there? Does it not pass out of the body in waves which flow around the world unperceived by our senses, just as the wireless waves passed unperceived before Hertz and others discovered their existence? Unquote.
Every failure is a blessing in disguise, providing it teaches some needed lesson one could not have learned without it. Most so-called failures are only temporary defeats.
Every mind, both a broadcasting and a receiving station. More times than I can enumerate, I have proven to my own satisfaction at least that every human brain is both a broadcasting and a receiving station for vibrations of thought frequency. If this theory should turn out to be a fact and methods of reasonable control should be established, imagine the part it would play in the gathering, classifying, and organizing of knowledge. The possibility, much less the probability of such a reality, is staggering. Thomas Paine was one of the great minds of the American Revolutionary period. To him, more perhaps, more than any other one person, we owe both the beginning and the happy ending of the Revolution. For it was his keen mind that both helped in drawing up the Declaration of Independence and in persuading the signers of that document to translate it into terms of reality. In speaking of the source of his great storehouse of knowledge, Paine thus described it, quote, "Any person who has made observations on the state of progress of the human mind by observing his own cannot but have observed that there are two distinct classes of what are called thoughts, those that we produce in ourselves by reflection and the act of thinking, and those that bolt into the mind of their own accord. I have always made it a rule to treat these voluntary visitors with civility, taking care to examine as well as I was able if they were worth entertaining, and it is from them I have acquired almost all the knowledge that I have. As to the learning that any person gains from school education, it serves only like a small capital to put him in the way of beginning learning for himself afterwards. Every person of learning is finally his own teacher, the reason for which is that principles cannot be impressed upon the memory. Their place of mental residence is the understanding, and they are never so lasting as when they begin by conception." Unquote. In the foregoing words, Paine describes an experience which at one time or another is the experience of every person. Who is there so unfortunate as not to have received positive evidence that thoughts and even complete ideas will pop into the mind from outside sources? I believe that every thought vibration released by every brain is picked up by the ether and kept in motion in circuitous wavelengths corresponding in length to the intensity of the energy used in their release, that these vibrations remain in motion forever, that they are one of the two sources from which thoughts which pop into one's mind emanate, the other source being direct and immediate contact through the ether with the brain releasing the thought vibration. Thus it will be seen that if this theory is a fact, the boundless space of the whole universe is now and will continue to become literally a mental library wherein may be found all the thoughts released by human beings.
Imagine what a part this principle plays in every walk of life. You have probably experienced it with those you love or with someone you work alongside. There you are, the both of you considering the solution to some problem, and you hit on the same idea at the same moment. You have probably also noticed that the intensity of thoughts can increase their power to affect other minds. When you listen to a passionate speaker, don't you sometimes know what will be said next, even the words that will be used? This may sometimes be due to simple logical interpretation, yet it is just as likely to happen when you are hearing someone speak on something you know little about. In such a case, you have little basis for anticipating anything. Yet, the power of the other person's thoughts conveys to you the ideas that are being expounded. Imagine, then, applying this effect to your pursuit of success through harmonious and purposeful alliance of two or more minds. Two words are key here: harmonious and purposeful.
Organized knowledge. I am here laying the foundation for one of the most important hypotheses enumerated in Lesson 3. This is a lesson on organized knowledge. Most of the useful knowledge to which the human race has become heir has been preserved and accurately recorded in nature's Bible. By turning back the pages of this unalterable Bible, we have read the story of the terrific struggle through and out of which the present civilization has grown. The pages of this Bible are made up of the physical elements of which this earth and the other planets consist, and of the ether that fills all space. By turning back the pages written on stone and covered near the surface of this earth on which we live, we have uncovered the bones, skeletons, footprints, and other unmistakable evidence of the history of animal life on this earth, planted there for our enlightenment and guidance by the hand of Mother Nature throughout unbelievable periods of time. The evidence is plain and unmistakable. The great stone pages of nature's Bible found on this earth and the endless pages of that Bible represented by the ether wherein all past human thought has been recorded constitute an authentic source of communication between the Creator and His creation. This Bible was begun before humankind had reached the thinking stage, indeed, before life had reached the amoeba or one-cell animal stage of development. This Bible is above and beyond our power to alter. Moreover, it tells its story not in the ancient dead languages or hieroglyphics, but in universal language, which all who have eyes may read. Nature's Bible, from which we have derived all the knowledge that is worth knowing, is one that no one may alter or in any manner tamper with. The most marvelous discovery yet made is that of the recently discovered radio principle. Imagine picking up the ordinary vibration of sound and transforming that vibration from audio frequency into radio frequency, sending it to a properly attuned receiving station and there transforming it back into its original form of audio frequency, all in the flash of a second. It should surprise no one that such a force could gather up the vibration of thought and keep that vibration in motion forever. The instantaneous transmission of sound by means of the modern radio apparatus makes not only possible but probable my theory. Thought vibration can connect mind to mind.
Napoleon Hill wrote those words in 1927, a time of great optimism in America. The economy was booming, and advances in science and industry were happening so swiftly that it seemed to many people that nothing was impossible. Needless to say, mind-to-mind communication did not happen in Hill's lifetime. However, if you take the extraordinary work being done at the beginning of the 21st century in communications technology and artificial intelligence, and combine it with the knowledge being gained about DNA and the human genome, it seems possible, perhaps even probable, that in some form, Hill's theory of mind-to-mind communication will be realized.
The Mastermind. We come now to the next step in the description of the ways and means by which one may gather, classify, and organize useful knowledge through harmonious alliance of two or more minds out of which grows a mastermind. I have searched in vain through all the textbooks and essays available on the subject of the human mind, but found nowhere even the slightest reference to the principle here described as the mastermind. The term first came to my attention through an interview with Andrew Carnegie, in the manner described in Lesson 2. Mind chemistry. It is my belief that the mind is made up of the same universal energy as that which fills the universe. It is a fact as well known to the layman as to the scientist that some minds clash the moment they come in contact with each other, while other minds show a natural affinity for each other. Between the two extremes of natural antagonism and natural affinity growing out of the meeting or contacting of minds, there is a wide range of possibility for varying reactions of mind upon mind. Some minds are so naturally adapted to each other that love at first sight is the inevitable outcome of the contact. Who has not known of such an experience? In other cases, minds are so antagonistic that violent mutual dislike shows itself at first meeting. These results occur without a word being spoken and without the slightest signs of any of the usual causes for love and hate acting as a stimulus. It is quite probable that the mind is made up of energy, and when two minds come close enough to each other to form a contact, the mixing of the units of this mind stuff sets up a chemical reaction and starts vibrations which affect the two individuals pleasantly or unpleasantly. The effect of the meeting of two minds is obvious to even the most casual observer. Every effect must have a cause. What could be more reasonable than to suspect that the cause of the change in mental attitude between two minds which have just come in close contact is none other than the disturbance of the electrons or units of each mind in the process of rearranging themselves in the new field created by the contact?
As Benjamin Disraeli wrote, "To believe in the heroic makes heroes."
For the purpose of establishing this lesson upon a sound foundation, we have gone a long way toward success by admitting that the meeting or coming in close contact of two minds sets up in each of those minds a certain noticeable effect or state of mind quite different from the one existing immediately prior to the contact. While it is desirable, it is not essential to know what is the cause of this reaction of mind upon mind. That the reaction takes place in every instance is a known fact which gives us a starting point from which we may show what is meant by the term mastermind. A mastermind may be created through the bringing together or blending in a spirit of perfect harmony of two or more minds. Out of this harmonious blending, the chemistry of the mind creates a third mind, which may be appropriated and used by one or all of the individual minds. This master mind will remain available as long as the friendly, harmonious alliance between the individual minds exists. It will disintegrate, and all evidence of its former existence will disappear the moment the friendly alliance is broken.
There is a strong parallel between what Hill here is saying about the interrelation of minds and the theories of the revolutionary philosopher, scientist, designer, Buckminster Fuller. In the introduction to Synergetics, Fuller writes, "Humanity has been deprived of comprehensive understanding. Specialization has bred feelings of isolation, futility, and confusion in individuals." Unquote. Hill believed that the mastermind draws its members out of their fields of specialization into a group, the power of which is greater than its component parts. Macrocosmically, Fuller believes that we must understand all elements and operations of the universe as interconnected. In Synergetics 303.00, he defines universe as the comprehensive, historically synchronous, integral aggregate system embracing all the separate integral aggregate systems of all men's consciously apprehended and communicated to self or others, non-simultaneous, non-identical, but always complementary and only partially overlapping, macro, micro, always and everywhere, omnitransforming, physical and metaphysical, weighable and unweighable event sequences. Universe is a dynamically synchronous scenario.